I am Randy Andrews, and today I've got Jared Savitas with me as we talk about one of his favorite movies, Conan the Destroyer. We'll talk about the cast, the background, our thoughts on the character, and his transformation from novels to film to comics. And of course, we'll also discuss the score, as well as that by Basil Palladoros. It's all today on Soundtrack Alley. I'm Randy Andrews. Jared, it's good to have you on the show today.
Oh, thanks, Randy. I'm so excited to be here. I'm excited to talk about the movie and the soundtrack, for sure.
Yeah. So what are your initial thoughts on Conan?
Oh, well, he is my favorite character from literature. And man, in 1983, I got my first, was the first comic books I ever bought. Mm-hmm. It was a King Conan, number 7 to be exact. And ever since then, I've just in love with the character. And so my entry into him was through the comic books. And then when I got into high school, read the books, and of course the movies fell in there too. So, yeah, I just really enjoy the character. I think he is, Robert E. Howard really, really made a lot of statements of civilization versus barbarism with the character. And I don't know, I just think that he's such a fun adventure character for me, I don't know. It's kind of hard for me to not just keep gushing and gushing about what I enjoy about him.
Well, Conan is an awesome action adventure character, and
for sure, yeah.
I mean, well known through, a long time ago. I mean, right up there with the characters of Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know?
Yeah, mm-hmm, for so. Sure. All the I love pulp characters. I just love all that stuff, you know, and all of these characters are what springboarded a lot of what we consider to be a part of the genre, you know, the sword and sorcery genre. And so there's a lot of history and a lot of importance with these characters, even if you think that, you know, he's just a toss off, you know, he's just a dumb barbarian or whatever. Arnold Schwarzenegger played him, whatever. He's just a goofball. You can say all that, but there's a lot of history and importance behind the character for sure.
Oh yeah, definitely. All right, so Jared, why don't we get into talking about the cast of Conan the Destroyer?
Mm-hmm. Enough talk.
So, what are your initial thoughts of Conan being Arnold Schwarzenegger coming back for Conan the Destroyer?
Well, of course, perfect. You know, I mean, like, it's hard for me to not think of him as the character, and to consider anybody else playing him. So him coming back, of course, is, you know, brilliant. There was no other choice at that time. You know, I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger was king of action films at that time too. So he, from what I understand, he bulked up more for this return. The director said that he felt that people got shorted out on seeing Arnold Schwarzenegger near nude in the first movie. And so with Destroyer, they're like, we're going to make sure that he's as in loincloth only as much as possible. You know, and the guy looks great, you know, yeah, and like his body is amazing.
totally ripped. So
yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And then, and then a year later he was in Red Sonja.
Yes, so. He was. Yeah. And it's funny. So with the Destroyer, the script got, this script got, you know, became more, teenager friendly. Mm-hmm. The original script was more R-rated along the lines of Conan the Barbarian, and they felt like they needed to market this movie to be open to a larger audience. And so Arnold Schwarzenegger himself did not like that they made this movie more silly and more family friendly, as to put it. And it actually is the reason why he walked away from continuing with the character, and because they were supposed to do Conan the Conqueror as a third movie. And he was like, no, you know, not after what you did with the character in Destroyer. So yeah, it's interesting. Like even like the script originally was written by Roy Thomas. And, you know, I mean, he's like he's the number one Conan the comic for Marvel Comics writer. Mm-hmm. And they changed his script so much, too, that he was like, yeah, this isn't even really the movie I wrote so much anymore, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they were trying to broaden their audience, which is, you know, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, with making it more family friendly, I guess it limited the character in a way.
It did, yeah, a little bit, yeah. He wasn't as, you know, even the violence is a little less graphic most of the time in the
movie. It's kind of cheesy.
Yeah.
but it's also fun.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of people give the movie a hard time, and you know, I mean, it was up for some Razzies, which, if you know, if you're familiar with the Razzie Awards, it's a bad award. You know, maybe the movie is kind of hokey at times and stuff. But my appreciation for the movie has only grown as I've gotten older. You know, even as a kid, and when people were saying it was bad, and I never felt that it was bad. Like to me it is a 1980s Marvel Conan comic book brought to life. Like it is such a comic. You can totally tell that Roy Thomas is all over it. And so I've always appreciated it for that. I've never really looked down on it. Even watching it now, I can see the cheesiness of it, and I can see how like all that effect is bad, or that fight scene was bad, but I still love it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, it was really interesting that in 2014, Schwarzenegger actually announced that he was going to return to Conan after 30 years regarding Legend of Conan.
Yeah.
And it was rumored to take place many years after the original Conan the Barbarian, and it would ignore Destroyer altogether and be its own thing. And I don't know if that's even still in the works at all, or.
Yeah. I mean, I'm with you. I've heard the same thing. I've heard it was on, I've heard it was off. I've heard that it got, you know, like was in like hold and then it was back on. So I don't know. I would love to see it. I'd love to see him coming back as an older version of the character. Obviously I would be fine with them automatically jumping to him in a king position and having him like return to adventuring after sitting on the throne and being bored, like, or even introduce like his offspring, and, you know, bring like his son in and have him run around with his kid and have his kid maybe move forward, make more movies off of him or something. I don't know, but whatever they do, I'll be there. I'll go see it.
Oh yeah. So what are your thoughts on Will Chamberlain?
I think he was great for the part, you know, I mean, like he's such a big guy and imposing, you know, like as that character, he's great. He's very silent most of the film. and doesn't have a whole lot of lines, but he did great. And like, he did all of his own stunts. Same with Grace Jones. I'm sure we'll cover it when we get to her, but the two of them, they did pretty much all of their own stunts. And watching the film, they do like, there's a pretty wicked horse fall they do too, where their horses clash together and they both fall off their horses and hit the ground, and it's them. Like, they, you know, they did that themselves. Yeah, I think Wilt is so fun in that role. Like, it's cool. It's the only movie that he ever did, but, you know,
his only,
he's great in it. Yeah.
Only IMDb role. Which is okay. I mean, you know, sometimes it's like you can have a standalone movie that sets you apart from everything else, and it's like, wow, he did a really good job with that role.
Yeah, and they had to. I know they had a lot of trouble finding a horse to fit him because he's such a big guy. So they had to have a horse shipped in from, I don't remember exactly where, but yeah, he was too tall for every other horse.
Oh yeah. And then I thought it was interesting because both Grace Jones and Wilt Chamberlain, they didn't get along on set.
Yeah, I heard that too. Yeah,
it was like Chamberlain kept asking Jones to turn down her boombox.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, that's, yeah, I could see that. But it was interesting that that actually came up. And then, you know, earlier we had talked about Arnold Schwarzenegger being too clothed for the first movie.
Yeah.
And then Richard Fleischer, I think that's how you say his name. But he said, I made sure that Arnold was undressed 99% of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and he is, man. He's just in that loincloth for pretty much the whole time.
Yeah. And then what about Olivia Diabo?
Yeah. Okay, so this is her first role. And you know, she was the one that was up for Worst Actress Razzie Award. She may even have won it, actually. But regardless, I don't think she's all that bad. I mean, not the acting throughout the movie isn't like, in, you know, top notch. You know, I mean, and it's just a cheesy action flick. So she's fine. Like I mean, I remember growing up when I saw this in high school. Man, I thought she was hot, and it was like, wow, this girl's great. But yeah, she's a little flaky and
over the top.
Yeah, like her line delivery isn't the best, but
Now, what's your connection to Grace Jones?
Well, okay, because you know, I knew Grace Jones in the '80s as this musician, pop musician, and I always thought she was such a weirdo because her videos and everything were so outlandish and crazy for the time. So when I heard that she was going to be in it, I was like, that's such an interesting choice. But I almost think she's kind of the best part of the cast. She plays a really fun character. I think she plays it really well. I know that she was really aggressive in the part, and she injured a lot of guys during the fight scenes, and even the fight scene she has with Wilt Chamberlain, and she bites him in the ear. She really bites him and really bloodies him, which might have also affected their relationship going forward. But and like I said, she did her own stunts. I think she's incredible in it. Like, she's so funny. She's got some of the best delivery and some of the funnest lines, you know, and her costume is great.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I think she's cool.
And she was in other movies. I thought
she was in a James Bond film.
Yeah. I couldn't remember. And then, like, it was interesting. Wilt Chamberlain claimed, this is just kind of odd, but he said that he claimed sexual encounters with over 20,000 women.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then, ironically, in this movie, Queen Taramis charges Chamberlain's character, Bombata, with...
Bombata.
What is it?
Bombata.
Bombata. Okay. And then with protecting Princess Jenna's virginity.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's kind of like ironic.
It is. That yeah. was
like a total switcheroo there.
And, that, and so that, and actually watching it and knowing that information, I was like, well, did he sleep with any of these female cast members? Like, I wonder.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. So what about the Queen Taramis character?
Sarah Douglas, yeah.
Yeah.
I think she's pretty great too. And you know, like I, you know, most people know her from Superman 2 as Ursa. Mm-hmm. And,
she wasn't in Red Sonja, was she? No, she wasn't.
No, she was not.
I didn't think so. She no, looked
that
like
was the was the actress from Conan the Barbarian was, in Sonja and okay. the girl that played Valeria. I do not remember that actress's name.
I'll yeah. I don't have it in here. So,
but yeah, no. Sarah Douglas is great as Queen Taramis. And I know that in order to make the film PG-13 or PG at the time, whatever it would be, they cut. She had a sex scene with Conan, and then she. Also, there's kind of a seductive scene she has with the statue of Dagoth, and both of those were cut to make the film more accessible and lower rating. But she's great. Sarah Douglas is great. I got a chance to interview her when she came to town for she was either here for a free comic book day, I think, event or something like that. And I did get to interview her. She was delightful. She's a great lady. I'm not familiar with other work that she's done beyond Superman and this film. So,
yeah, I know she's probably had some character like she's probably a great character actor. Mm. She's probably been in little roles throughout the years, but nothing like. As major as, say, Conan the Destroyer or even Superman 2 that most people are familiar with. So
they gave her great gowns and costumes in this film, man.
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah, the costuming in
great.
This
her armor, movie. Everything. She's great. Yeah.
The costuming in this movie was top-notch. Mm-hmm. I'd have to say that, like, the level of, like, how they tried to get so much authenticity, like, you know, making the costumes look more for that time period or something, you know, making it look better. I know we had talked about Arnold Schwarzenegger finding that the script was too childish, and he even convinced the producers to make this movie more serious. And of course, his tryings failed, and eventually he lost interest, and as we talked about, he walked away. I thought it was interesting that Maria Shriver visited the set and rode with Arnold up into the mountains on horses where they had a picnic.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was interesting.
I really am impressed with the horse riding of all of the cast in the film. Like when I watch it and the way they handle the horses is so natural. Like they all take to it so well, and they are very like, they're making these horses do all this like quick action, and everybody does a great job with the horses. So that's kind of a fun little story that they rode up.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I thought that was neat. Did you know that Andre the Giant was in this movie?
Yes. I did know that he was, Dagoth, the when he becomes a spoiler, when he becomes a monster at the end.
Yeah, he was the horned giant.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool.
There's a pretty great still photo behind the scenes of Arnold with Wilt and Andre, and they're like, they tower over Arnold. It's hilarious. And then there's another one where they're both like holding him up. It's some pretty fun behind the scenes photos.
Yeah, and I would imagine that in a lot of scenes, they probably had to actually make Wilt look shorter.
Yeah, I wonder if they did. I mean, he's so big.
Yeah. Incredible. Really tall guy. So, All right. Well, let's talk about some of the background on the film and the technical aspects.
Okay.
Behind the dragon, there's a tunnel. It could be our only way out.
The jewel. Take the jewel. Hurry, hurry.
That way.
All right, so John Milus, who is the director of Conan the Barbarian, he wasn't available for Conan the Destroyer. So the studio took a more active role when they had him on the first film, and it led to serious mistakes. And according to Schwarzenegger, through his latest autobiography. And then after the phenomenon of E.T., Universal thought Conan the Destroyer would make more money if it were family entertainment, and Schwarzenegger argued against this. And then the director for Conan the Destroyer, which was Richard, is it Fleischer?
Fleischer? I'm not sure.
It's with an L, so F L E I S C H E R. Maybe it's Fleischer? Not sure. He agreed with Schwarzenegger, but he had to comply with Universal's wishes to make it more like the comic book, which actually made sense in a way.
Yeah.
And then, although it outgrossed Conan the Barbarian, it didn't do as well in the U.S., and that was because it was more family-friendly. And then he later expressed the same fears with Terminator 2, when the Terminator was forbidden to kill anyone.
Yeah, right? That's hilarious.
Yeah. And then Schwarzenegger and Dino De Laurentiis both washed their hands of the series, and with Schwarzenegger opting out to do different contemporary movies from that point on. And so it was just really interesting. And like we had talked before, that Wilt Chamberlain had a hard time with them finding a horse because he was so tall and his feet actually just touched the ground with any horse that they would choose. And so they finally found one in Spain because they had to import it to Mexico so that way he could actually fit on the horse.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty cool. And have you, I've been to the Iowa State Fair and have seen, some of those draft horses.
Yeah.
At the Iowa State Fair, and those things are really large. And I mean, you've probably been to the Nebraska State Fair and seen some of those. And
yeah, horses are big animals, so I know there's breeds that are really big, so I'm not surprised they
had to get something really tall. So let's see. Grace Jones, she had two stuntmen. This is hilarious because she had two stuntmen put into the hospital by accident with a fighting stick. And she trained for 18 months to prepare for this film, which was pretty cool because she was a pretty good action fighter in this film.
Yeah, man. She's, like I said, she's a blast. She's kind of my favorite part of it.
Yeah. And then, like you had talked about, Roy Thomas and then Jerry Conway. They wrote the original story treatment for this movie, and they were displeased by the screenplay that was by Stanley Mann and then what the finished film was. And so they made their story into the graphic novel Conan the Horn of Azoth. Yes. Now, can you tell me a little bit about that comic?
Yeah, so, what they did for that comic is so Michael, I believe it's Daugherty. I'm not sure how you say his last name, but he took over penciling Conan comics after I believe John Buscema is kind of he drew more issues of Conan than anybody else. When he passed. I believe Michael Daugherty took over, or he might have moved on at that point. I'm not exactly sure, but either way, yeah. So they released that as kind of a magazine-sized graphic novel, mm-hmm. those square bound ones that Marvel did through their Epic line. And it's the original story script for Destroyer. So they changed the names of the god and all the characters so that they weren't like, you know, they wanted to step away from the film.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. And I've not read it. It's on my list of books that I'm trying to hunt down and find, but,
is it easily obtained?
Oh, through the secondary market, you know, okay. I mean, like it's found on eBay and stuff like that. So, it's out there.
Okay.
But really, I didn't know that they had done that. I was always aware of the 2-issue official the movie adaptation that I still have. They're from 1985. And what I find really interesting about the movie adaptation is there's no credits inside the book. So when you look in it, it doesn't tell you who wrote it. Doesn't tell you who drew it. It doesn't tell you anything. And it's very choppy and light in its adaptation, but it does contain, you can see where it does contain the scenes that were cut. Like the implied sex scene between Conan and Queen Taramis. And there's a point where Queen Taramis is anointing the statue of her god, and that's probably where this like weird statue seduction scene went in. And then there's another scene where Jenna talks about she has this nightmare, because she has a nightmare in the film. She has a nightmare, and that you don't really know much about it. But in the comic adaptation, she explains to Conan around a campfire what her dream is, and it's about her aunt Queen Taramis murdering her parents.
Oh wow.
And then taking her. So I think that it's interesting because it shows scenes that were cut. But like I said, you don't know who, I'm not sure who wrote it. I think I looked online and people are saying Roy Thomas, but then they also have the wrong, they say Bob Camp is the penciler and he's not. Bob Camp did the covers. But John Buscema drew the interiors.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know. It's really strange to me. I don't, you know, you don't really run into that where they don't acknowledge the creators of the book.
Well, yeah. And I mean, they did a whole, it was almost like Marvel did a whole line of movie adaptations through the 1980s. Like they did Dune, they did Buckaroo Banzai.
Yep.
Ironically, like as we're recording this, my episode for Buckaroo Banzai goes up tomorrow. So that's pretty awesome.
They did Kroll and
they did
James Bond. They did everything
of these movie adaptations. But I have the original Conan the Barbarian one, and that one's pretty obscure too. Like you know, they don't give a whole lot of detail. And I think they actually do list some of it in there.
Yeah. So I don't know if it's, you know, if it's because of the, all of this unhappiness around the script and stuff, why they don't credit people in the adaptation. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So that should be one of both of our goals, is try to hunt down this Conan, the Horn of Azoth.
Yeah, I'm really, really interested in it now, because now that I know that it's not just, because I've been slowly getting those Conan epic graphic novels.
Okay.
And I've been kind of getting one here and there, you know, just whenever I have an extra little bit of spending money. And that's on the list, but due to like me being more interested in some of the other ones or the creators involved in the other ones, I've gone for those first. But now that I know that this, what it is, the story behind it, like man, now that thing's moving up. Like I want to get that thing
as
soon as I can so I can check it out.
It's like me and certain Gen 13 issues that I'm still looking for. And then this was interesting. Some of the scenes that were filmed in the movie for Conan the Destroyer were at the same location as scenes that were shot for the movie Dune.
Ah, and wow, I didn't know that. That's pretty good.
Yeah, and then also like to create the hilltop city of Shadazar, the crew built a tiny model and placed it in front of the camera. And so the model then is known as a foreground miniature, which is pretty cool because, I mean, they've done that with several films in the 80s and just even like how they used miniatures for so many things with like Star Wars and different things. And that's pretty cool how they, you know, set up those buildings and stuff.
Yeah, it's a lot. There's a lot to be said for the practical effects of the 80s, you know, like the costuming and like you said, the miniatures, like, you take so much of it for granted, but there's a lot of talent and work that went into that stuff. And sometimes it looks way better.
Oh yeah.
Than a lot of the CGI stuff we get nowadays.
Cause it actually looks more real.
Yeah.
Like it's actually real. Yeah. Yeah. It's real things. Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting. The swords that were in the movie cost $10,000 each.
Well, that's one thing I love about the series, especially the first movie. The sword designs for the three thieves, the three main characters in the first movie. Conan has two different swords. He has the Atlantean sword, and then he has the sword that his father made. And then Subutai and Valeria's swords, those swords are they're gorgeous. They're pieces of artwork. Mm-hmm. And for them to do that again for this film just makes total sense. And The only thing that I think is kind of funny is there's one point where Wilt Chamberlain's character, Bumbata, he uses a kind of like a scimitar-shaped sword.
Oh, yeah.
And when he fights, when he goes up to fight, he doesn't go up to fight Zula, which is Grace Jones's character. He goes up just to speak to her, and it becomes a fight.
Mm-hmm.
He uses his sword, and it looks like a toothpick in his hand. Like it's probably perfectly sized for you or I.
Yeah.
But a giant man like him, like it looks kind of small.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny, pretty fun little scene for sure.
Oh yeah, definitely. I thought it was interesting, you know, not to skip to the end for this little tidbit, but there were six people that actually controlled the Dagoth monster, working its arms, mouth, eyes, and body.
Yeah.
That was quite a creature too. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a crew almost on par with the, you know, what it took to control Jabba.
Yeah.
From Return of the Jedi. But you watch the film and it doesn't really look like that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It looks like Andre, aside from, of course, the mouth and the eyes, which are obviously remote controlled from somewhere. It looks like he's moving the bodysuit pretty well on his own, but I imagine, like looking at it, because I just watched it last night and a little bit more again today to kind of revisit it, it does look incredibly heavy. So yeah. I'm sure he did need help moving it around.
Well, in like a previous episode that I've done with like the Neverending Story, they had 25 people working on just the facial features of Falcor.
Oh, that's incredible. And then like to think that the coordination it would take for them all to be moving together to get those expressions.
Yeah. Yeah.
For Falcor, that's mind boggling.
Yeah, it is. It just was crazy. The sequence where Conan fights Thoth Ammon, the monster, in the Chamber of Mirrors.
Yes.
It was influenced by the famous final battle between Lee and Han in Enter the Dragon, in which Lee and Han, they fought each other in a room full of mirrors, and then Lee was smashing the mirrors to foil Han's illusions, and then it allowed him to defeat it. And so Conan defeats it by breaking all the mirrors as well.
Yeah, and the creature that Thoth Ammon changes into is also a callback to there's a creature in a Conan story called Rogues in the House. There's a creature, a man ape. His name is Thak, and he wears a red cloak. And so they have this red cloaked man ape creature in Destroyer, which is, you know, they're kind of a call back to Thak, which I found really interesting. There's a lot of little tidbits in Destroyer that are taken from Robert E. Howard's stories and just kind of mishmashed into this film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I thought it was good that, I mean, this was a unique little tidbit on how during the film's climax, Conan is seen in the closing epilogue sitting upon his throne many years after the events of doing this film as a king in his own hand. And he's decorated with his two side weapons, the spear, the staff, and a sword. And the sword, however, isn't his Atlantean sword, and that he discovered in the first film. And yet he was supposed to have it at this end. So it was they kind of altered things for that, you know.
Yeah, it's epilogue. It's actually the sword, his father's sword, which he discarded in Conan the Barbarian after using it to defeat Thulsa Doom at the end of that movie. He discards it. So it is interesting. I would love to see that story where he reclaimed that sword and had it reforged to be a complete blade. Be an epic story along the line of Narsil from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure. and that's, I mean, that's, it's interesting that they use that same closer too, because that's how they do the end scrolling in Conan the Barbarian too, is Conan on a throne as king.
Interesting.
You can see they always wanted to do it, you know, so Conan the Conqueror would have been the story of him getting his throne for sure.
Yeah. And then, like, it would be, like, I haven't read much Conan, like, in general. I mean, I have the original stories on an ebook, but I haven't had a chance to read it. Currently, I'm reading Sherlock Holmes, so.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah, slowly working through that giant book. Like one thing that stands out to me is where is the story, or where are we getting the story after he's been king?
Yeah. You know,
where is that story? I mean, you know, we talked about it with Arnold saying, hey, I'd come back and do Legend of Conan.
Yeah.
But it's like, where is the story that we could get and actually would show like a more seasoned character? So.
Yeah, I'm ready for it. Like, let's bring it on. If everybody, you know, get everybody on board, let's do it.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, one other little tidbit regarding this is Roger Donaldson was originally chosen to direct, but with the producer Dino De Laurentiis, he moved him over for The Bounty, which was in 1984. And then John Milius recommended Richard Fleischer, who had worked with De Laurentiis before and who directed The Vikings. And so this was one of Milius's favorite movies to be able to work on. So that was unique in the way of they bringing that all together. And it's really interesting to look back on some of these, you know, film directors and where they've come from. And I mean, you look at Dino De Laurentiis. I mean, he was like a giant for directors at the time. And so that was pretty cool.
Yeah. You know, another thing before we get away from it, the adaptation of the novelization of the movie was written by Robert Jordan, which is a huge name.
Yeah. For fantasy,
for his own fantasy series, but he actually, I want to say in the 80s, he took over writing some Conan books, and he did way more with that character in novels than I realized that he did, and that's, I came across that secondarily, because when I was getting into the novelizations, I was just focused on the Robert E. Howard stuff and then the El Sprague de Camp stuff, and that Jordan stuff just kind of I guess I really hadn't really paid much attention to it. But man, yeah, his library with that character is pretty big, pretty significant.
Yeah. And then one other thing that I like to point out, I used to listen to a podcast called Podcastle, which it's still going on. And they had reintroduced a story, like it was a reprint of one of Robert E. Howard's original stories, like regarding in regard to like the elephant's jewel or elephant's heart.
Oh yeah. Tower of the Elephant. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was like he was a jewel colored elephant and he was an alien.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that whole story was showing that Conan at one point in his life was a thief.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of cool to look back on his younger years and see what he was doing before he became like a barbarian. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He had a lot of, he jumped around a lot. He covered a lot of things. You know, he was a soldier. He was a sailor. He was a thief. He was, you know, just a straight barbarian. Yeah. Conan, pretty well-rounded guy.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Of that, like speaking of, like if you want to put him into genres of character, that I'll get, you know, I play a lot of role-playing games. I play Dungeons and Dragons, I play Pathfinder. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite things to do with literary characters is think about them as classes and like how would I build that character if I wanted to play him in the game. And a lot of, you know, I'm part of a lot of like groups that talk about these games and stuff. And every once in a while, someone will pipe up and say, well, if I want to watch movies, you know, what's a good Dungeons and Dragons like movie? I feel like Conan the Destroyer is not only is it a perfect reflection of the comics from the 80s, it's a great movie. It's like, to me, it's like the best Dungeons and Dragons movie ever made.
Because
you have, if you will break it down, you could say Conan's the barbarian, Bumbata's the fighter, Malik is the thief, Zula is the berserker, and then you have Akiro is the wizard. So like you have the classes. They go on a quest where it's like get this thing to get that thing to do this thing, and then you fight an elder god at the end. Like you find it, you know, there's an end boss. It's totally a game.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And that's a part of my growing appreciation of the film is seeing it as more than just this kind of B movie sword and sandal thing. It's got a lot more depth for me.
Oh yeah.
So it's kind of funny.
Yeah. It's actually kind of cool, you know. I mean, just looking at it from a different perspective and seeing these character building, and like you could see how they were trying to do this world building
of
having more than just Conan be in the character role and have these other characters littered throughout that actually mean something to that universe. So I like that idea too. Well, let's start talking a little bit about the score. I mean,
yeah,
I have
probably should, huh?
I have quite a bit on this. And one thing that really I appreciated was the whole Conan the Barbarian score. And I mean, that's a very well-known score. And
Basil
Palidoris, he did such an amazing job with that.
I agree. Score. Yeah.
And for a lot of film score fans, they're not as much of a fan of this score as they are of the original. But, you know, with Conan the Destroyer, Basil Palidoris, he did like a two-piece cue, kind of like a offshoot adventure called The Adventures of Conan, A Sword and Sorcery Spectacular. And that was in 1983. And it was kind of a pathway to get through the weight of what Conan the Barbarian was thematically and like through the film music and everything. And you get those unique pieces of the original theme from Conan. And then you have these glorious, like epic sounding pieces that are brought in through Conan the Destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
And I have that whole like piece of the Adventures of Conan, the Sword and Sorcery Spectacular. And it's about 30 minutes long, and it's only two tracks.
Okay.
It's only two tracks of music.
I've not heard it. Yeah.
But it's really good. I should get it to you. Cause it's like, that's pretty epic.
Yeah.
And it's really well done. And Basil Palladoros did it. And he was put at a disadvantage for this movie, contending not only with the abandonment of the attitude that made the first film a classic, but also he was forced to write it smaller, with an inferior orchestra, and it had no chorus. Now, when you think about the first film and the music for that film, it had this amazing chorus, and
mm-hmm.
Basil Palladoros, he's kind of known for that, having that chorus in the background. I mean, he did it with Hunt for Red October, and I think he did it for Starship Troopers at one point in the film. And I mean, he's just well known for that type of thing. But even despite those disadvantages, his resulting score, it may have suffered a little bit, but he attempted to recreate the sound from the ancient times of having rhythmic and lyrical moments, and his work reflected, even though it was reflected as lighter, and it was a shift of emphasis for what the score was needing to be, he really emphasized how that opening Crom theme really drove into it with even, what was it called? Riders of Doom.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, you can really hear it in Elite Guard Attacks and the Dream Quest.
Mm-hmm.
And with Conan's own theme being in Riddle of Steel. I really like that. What are your initial thoughts on how this score varies from the original?
Well, I find it very interesting that people feel that it's an inferior score, because he revisits a lot of the original score in this one, you know? So, like, there's... And in the film itself, he reuses pieces from the original film. So, like, in when Conan is seduced by Queen Taramis to do this job for her, to take up this quest for her, she uses the death of his love from the first movie. And so during that scene and during that orchestral piece, the piece is called Wifing, I believe, from the first film,
mm-hmm.
is mixed into Valeria Remembered in this piece.
Yep.
And then same with like the approach to Shadazar. There's a piece from the original film. So like he uses parts from that first score in this score.
Mm-hmm.
So for people to say, it's inferior, I'm like, well, it's mixed with the first one. I don't understand. And, you know, like the piece you brought up, the Riders of Doom,
mm-hmm.
and it's mixed in with the opening theme, and it's also revisited in the piece Conan Battles Bombata.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chorus of bells that comes up at one point, and I would never think that hearing bells in an orchestra piece would get me super pumped. But like when those bells kick in on those pieces, I just get such a thrill. I'm just like, yeah, like, oh man. So like, and I get that same feeling when I listen to the original score and, you know, they do the Anvil of Crom,
mm-hmm.
which is such a powerful piece. Like that first score is my favorite soundtrack of all time. And this has, you know, just as much maybe not just as much, but it has just a strong effect on me, more or less.
Yeah.
I really like the Destroyer soundtrack. I think that it's, but like you said, it's much shorter. Like each piece on it is like 2-3 minutes long, except for one piece is about 6.5. But everything else is like this original soundtrack that was released, only like 35 like minutes long.
2-3 minutes.
Yeah.
A cue. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really short.
Yeah. And one thing I noticed is with like Valeria Remembered, it does offer this like hearty performance of the love theme from Conan. And it just, it seemed like just a lot of people just downgraded this film a little lower because of the score. And it's like, Basil Pallodorus, he did the best that he could to bring out those themes from the original. And like the two prominent themes in Conan the Destroyer are summarized with elite guard attacks and then the Crystal Palace. And that's an amazing, really long piece for Crystal Palace, because it's just, it's wide and open. And I thought it was really interesting. Have you ever seen Cherry 2000?
Oh, yeah. Yes, of course.
All right.
With Molly Ringwald, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And
No. I'm sorry.
No, not Molly Ringwald.
That's another different Wasteland movie. It's Melody Griffith, right?
Yes. Yep. Yep.
There we go.
That's it. And like, it's interesting because he uses, Basil Pallodorus used a foreshadowing of that film at 4 minutes into Crystal Palace.
Really?
Yeah. And so this action-packed confrontation and battle music exists at nearly the same level that had been with the previous effort with Conan the Barbarian. And like you brought up with Conan and Bombetta, that cue makes a really strong use of the sequel's score rhythmic fighting motif. And it's just, it's unique and highly exhilarating. Mm-hmm. And I've been listening to the score in my car and I can't stop listening to it, actually. Yeah. It's such a good, you know, sprinkling of the original themes and everything. And it just makes it this, you know, glorious, exciting film music.
Yes.
And I don't get how people did not appreciate it for really what it was.
I agree. I listened when my son was born, whom I named Conan. I listened to the Destroyer soundtrack like on a loop. The day he was born and the day after, because I would run from the hospital to come home and feed the dogs and get supplies and go back. And so I was listening to it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. The soundtrack to me, when you compare it to the first one, I feel like the first one is really heavy on setting the tone of the world and the character. And I feel like this soundtrack comes in with that established, and it comes in saying, this is an adventure. Like immediately is like adventure, you know, like it has such a powerful, like exciting, like, here we go, we're doing it. You know who this character, you know where we're going and what's happening. And it's a great backdrop to what is happening. I think it's great. I don't think it's as powerful as Barbarian, but I don't think it's any really less of a score, for sure.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like in Shadazar, the grand heraldic fanfare reprises with the processional Mountain of Power theme.
Yeah,
and that's from the first film.
Yes,
and then you have like the town source music that he imparts this medieval sensibility with like flutes and oboes and clarinets and these harps, and you can really feel it even in the film, like when they're going through this bazaar or, you know, this, you know, market, and you can really see the sense of that type of scoring, and it reminded me of the Florin dance in The Princess Bride. In a way, like not as much, but I mean, sure, you know, yeah, that similarity of, you know, having that type of style. And then even with Zula, that theme is really cool because it's like this timpani brass and, you know, these, you know, hardcore, like really deep woodwind, not, yeah, woodwinds, yeah, it would be. And I mean, it just was an amazing, like, you know, makes you really get excited for the music. And mm-hmm. I really appreciated it. And I mean, there's so much that could be said, but I'm not going to go into too much because there's so much in regard to this score that actually benefits it. And there's so much that people don't understand that this score gets the height and the depth from the original, and how good Basil Palladoras did,
yes,
with composing it. And so today I was gonna have us play a few cues from Conan the Destroyer, and so I'll play Riders of Tamaris, and I'm gonna play two different parts. There's two different parts to this. There's a part one, and then there's a part two, but it's a take two. Like, there's two takes of that piece, which was part two. And then I'll play Approach to Shadazar. And I really like how these show the original Conan theme and take us in a new direction for the character. Do you have any thoughts on these cues? I should have sent you information on it.
Oh, no. So the Riders of Tamaris, within... When you hit the 1 minute mark, I want to say somewhere like 50 some seconds into it, those bells will kick in that I mentioned earlier, and I think that they're really, that's a real, really cool. And then the shadows are like, yeah, that's kind of got that revisit from the original soundtrack. They're both wonderful, wonderful pieces. I'm excited for everybody to hear them.
Yeah.
The one thing I did discover when I was looking. They re-released the soundtrack.
Yeah, they did. Through La La Land
expansion.
Record. Yep.
Yeah. But I can't seem to find it anywhere.
You can film it. There's two different places that you can find it. One is La La Land Records.
Okay.
And then they have it on Film Score Monthly.
Okay.
I think it's on there, and it's the price of the score is about $30.
Oh yeah,
I think it's a little pricey, but it's like, it's for the one on La La Land Records, it's like a two disc, and
yeah,
it, you know, it's this expanded edition, and it's pretty cool to have, because it's
for got, sure, yeah, like
different artwork, and I can send you the link to that after.
Oh, I'd love to see it.
Yeah,
check it out a little bit more, because I know that they did it and that they expanded it, because it is a super, like, the as you get the original, you know, you get this soundtrack as it's first released, super short. You know,
oh,
like,
yeah,
half hour worth of music.
Yep.
And to me, it seemed strange. I was like, you know, especially when you watch the movie and there's other pieces that are not on the soundtrack. And I'm like, well, mm-hmm. why yeah. didn't you give us all of it?
Yeah. It's it's an expanded edition. And it has, like I mentioned, like the take one or take two,
yes,
pieces. And then there's like the part two, and we'll play another couple of these as we go along. But
okay.
Let's go ahead and play that.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, so next, I've got Amazonian Castle of Toth Ammon, Underwater Passage Hall, or Underwater Passage and Hall of Crystals, and then I'd like to play the Crystal Palace. Now, these also highlight Basil Pallador's way of bringing out like new themes and carrying in the cinematic feel for the film to give us this epic fantasy feel to our world that we're into. Now, what do you think of these?
These are great too. You know, like you said, they're great at like building these moods and building the location, you know, because you know, these are areas they go to on this quest. You know, the Toth Ammon's castle is a destination, and of course it's going to have its own feel and its own, you know, like it takes you another place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's great about, you know, all these other pieces. They're not necessarily the sweeping epic action
mm-hmm.
of these other themes. You know, like there's a handful of pieces that on the Destroyer soundtrack that are like
straight action.
Straight action. And then you have these other like set piece, mood piece pieces that are beautiful on their mm-hmm. own. But they are so different, you know, from the adventure pieces.
But there is a good balance, like how they even segue.
Yeah, they complement each other really well.
Yeah, to really show you like a different area, you know, mm-hmm. to not only create a mood, but to create the environment.
Yes.
Of where they were and what the Crystal Palace was and, you know, how they're getting into it and everything. So, so now I'm going to play those.
Thank you.
right, so sadly, we've come down to another end of Soundtrack Alley. Jared, I'd like to thank you for being on the show today.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me. It was a pleasure, if you couldn't tell.
Hey, I've thoroughly enjoyed having you. It's been a real pleasure to be able to talk to you about the character, and it's one of your favorite characters.
Oh, my ultimate favorite character. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so for us ending the show today, I'll be playing Elite Guards Attack, The Scrolls of Skellus, Conan and Bombata Battle, and then lastly, I'll play The Kiss and Epilogue and End Credits. And The Kiss cue is actually really short. It's like 30 seconds, but it's wonderful. It's a wonderful little tiny cue that really fits the scene. So I'd like to thank Alexander Schiebel for composing my intro music today. And you can find his work at xanderscores.com. Jared, where can people find you?
Okay, I'm on Twitter at Willie Toots, and I also am on a podcast where we play Pathfinder. It's a live play podcast. It's called Pathgrinders 3 Die Deep. You can find us in usually places. Goodpencil.com is where you will find a host of podcasts all within that genre. If you're interested in that kind of stuff at all.
Cool. Well, that's pretty awesome. In fact, I give you credit on my recorded answer of the week for Joe and Matt.
I'll look forward to that, because I listen to that quite every week.
Because that's this Saturday that they're recording it. So it's pretty cool, because I was having so much fun with recording it, and so I think you'll really appreciate it.
I look forward to it.
So you can find me at soundtrackalley.net, soundtrackalley.podbean.com. Find me on iTunes, Soundtrack Alley, Facebook, Instagram. I'm on Twitter at RandallAndrews1, and you can email me at soundtrackalley@yahoo.com. So that's it for today, and until next time, happy listening.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley, the podcast. I hope you take the time to review my podcast on iTunes or even listen to it on Podbean. With your review, it helps me get noticed on iTunes. Thank you so much. Have a good day. Thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley Spotlight. If you are on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review the show. Also, if you want to leave a comment, question, or concern, please email me at soundtrackalley@gmail.com and enjoy looking at my blog at soundtrackalley.com.